The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic, yet realistic, mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Hi, I'm Alexander Brown, and you're listening to the Culturico podcast online at culturico.com. Today's podcast will be an interview with Kevin Creon, an Irish artist, lecturer, and writer, and we'll be talking about intersections in his work between art, the ideals of the Enlightenment and Romanticism, and geopolitical themes. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
I'm very well. Lovely to have you on the Culturico podcast.
Thanks very much.
I thought we could start just by asking you a bit about yourself, if you could maybe introduce who you are and what you do and what maybe excites you about your work.
Well, I grew up in America, actually. My father worked for Aer Lingus in Boston and New York. And then my parents wanted to move to Ireland. They met in London. My mother is Austro-Hungarian, and so I moved to Ireland. So since the age of six, I've been living in Ireland. I went to art college, NCAD, National College of Art and Design in Dublin. And then a few years later, I went on to Dublin City University and I did a master's in communications and cultural studies. And then I continued on with my tutor, great tutor, Professor Michael Crone. And we worked on my PhD, which is basically looking at the history of the Irish language from the formation of Cumann na Gaeilge up to, well, what was then the current time of around 2000. And rewriting the history of the Irish language more from a political perspective, how elites used and abused the language for their own ends, really, is the idea. And that was then eventually published into a book called Language from Below. And since then, I've been teaching part-time. I work part-time for Boston University, teaching history of Irish art and aesthetics. And I've continued my interests in art from art college, which is looking at how art can be used in a kind of social political sense, how it relates, art relates to ordinary people. And that's always fascinated me. How can art kind of make an intervention in what's going on politically? So my interests kind of expand from there into geopolitics. And I started looking at the history of geopolitics and looking at what was going on around the world politically. And that led me into kind of an art series of looking at what I call Below the Bottom Rung, which is looking at people in the worst living and dying conditions on the planet. And that became a kind of series of paintings I was working on. And at the same time, I started doing more and more research into kind of the history of the arts. And then started looking into the Enlightenment and the reaction to the Enlightenment, Romanticist ideas. And that has resulted now in a book I just published recently called Against Romanticism, with a subtitle From Enlightenment to Enfrightenment and the Culture of Slavery. So that's kind of a general overview of what I've been doing here for the last few years. At the moment, I'm basically working within a triangle of teaching part-time, painting, and researching and writing articles. So I'm hoping to use the articles I'm publishing at the moment. They will be incorporated into the Against Romanticism book, and I will bring the book out again next year in a second edition, an expanded edition. So I decided this year I'd kind of spend the time learning how to publish, and that way I could publish books myself. But it would also give me a lot of scope for expanding the books and to making them more and more broader and deeper at the same time.
So the theme, like your book Against Romanticism, is very central to your work, or you see it that way. So I was wondering if maybe we could unpack the worldview that's informing that book, and that might also allow you to talk more about specific choices and in your art subjects and so on. So in terms of Enlightenment and Romanticism, what is the relationship between these two that you hypothesize in the book, and how does it relate to your art?
So because I've kind of been interested in ordinary people and art, it kind of fascinated me that most art that you see in galleries, unless it's kind of folksy genre paintings, they generally depict monarchs, the bishops, the aristocracy, you know, the wealthy middle classes. And if they ever, you know, depict ordinary people or workers, it suddenly becomes socialist realism. You know? So I've been very interested in social realism and looking at, going back to like an art college, it always kind of fascinated me, like, because we were working within modernist modes of art, which still had content, but, you know, people worked in all different kinds of forms when they were working and painting. But it always fascinated me, this idea that you had kind of radical art, radical left art, and radical right art, all kind of fitted within the modernist mode. How could it contain extremes, you know, the same kind of ideology? And it was something I've never really fully understood in my mind. So I decided, I kind of started off there because art is the area I was more familiar with. And I started looking at the definitions of modernism, and it kind of surprised me that it said suspicion of reason was one of the parts of the definition. That kind of, because I always thought modernism as kind of scientific in a way, but this kind of took me aback a bit. And then I looked at the definition of postmodernism, and of course that had suspicion of reason as well, because very much, postmodernism is more about content, whereas modernism is more about the breakdown of form. Postmodernism is breakdown of content, the idea of the end of the grand narratives, etc. And then I looked up a thing called metamodernism, which basically said, oh, we'll throw in a bit of modernism, a little bit of postmodernism, and it's like kind of like romanticism. So in other words, I realized that this had come to full circle, because romanticism itself is rooted in suspicion of reason as well as a reaction to the Enlightenment. So here we had romanticism with, its descendants, modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism. So I was really fascinated by this. So I started looking at Enlightenment and the ideas of Enlightenment, particularly in art, where, you know, there was an interest in anatomy, perspective, you had a tone, all these kind of scientific elements that came in to art. And this idea then of realism, in a way, they're kind of looking at the science of art, like anatomy, for example, then kind of develops into naturalism, which develops into realism. And this starts to change the whole aesthetic of art from the aesthetics of beauty to the aesthetics of ugliness. As, you know, like if you take during the middle of the 19th century, the whole aesthetic of beauty was, you know, the people looking beautiful, the beautiful environments, beautiful paintings, suddenly changed to workers and Van Gogh painting an old pair of boots and, workers and people, you know, like Courbet's paintings, you know, of ordinary people. And in fact, Courbet's two most famous paintings, the ones in the gallery in Paris, the name suddenly slips me, but they were sitting in his studio for like 20 years after he died. Nobody was interested in them. So then the whole idea then of social realism, which becomes more consciously looking at what's going on in society. And then, of course, then you get to the idea of socialist realism, which isn't just simply, oh, isn't it terrible how peasants and, you know, workers are treated? You know, this is how horrible their lives are. But into a conscious peasant and a conscious worker consciously changing society, you know, which became known as socialist realism, and changing it, of course, towards socialist ideology. And so this kind of interested me, because I was looking then at the Enlightenment philosophers and looking at what were their intentions when they were using this science, because that's what we think of, you know, Enlightenment is associated with science. And the more I read then, the more I realized that the philosophes weren't that interested in science as they were interested in ways of combating injustice. For example, you have ideas to make everybody equal before the law in the Republican idea. You had ideas against the death penalty, ideas against torture, the idea of people having individual rights. You had Grotius, who was interested in international law. And so what they were trying to do was create a better life and existence for everybody. And these became the Enlightenment ideals. And I suppose I see then the realism and socialism carrying those ideals down through time as descendants of Enlightenment. So in the end, then I started to think then of Romanticism really as a reactionary ideology, because for a long time I couldn't figure out how is it possible Neo-Gothic, which is a reaction to Classicism, was full of craft and design and decoration. And you had in the 1930s, you know, Bauhaus, which is absolute minimalism, seeing, you know, the ultimate of modernism, which was a descendant of Romanticism, as well as Neo-Gothic. And I was thinking, how is it possible to completely opposite art aesthetics could be part of the same movement? And it struck me then that maybe Bauhaus was kind of a reaction to what was going on in the Soviet Union, where decoration was starting to come back into art again. And so then I thought, well, maybe what happens is that what you have is always the elites. Whenever any kind of Enlightenment-based movement starts to gain a foothold, they kind of come in and react to it and effectively destroy it or take it on board to an extent that they can, you know, use the form or change the content, for example. So these are generally the ideas of the book. And so it came together in the sense that I started then looking at, I started calling the movements, the ideas related around Romanticism and its descendants of modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism as a culture of slavery, because they're always constantly, like, they're, you know, rooted in as fantasy, terror, horror, egotistic, romantic, all of these even elements of science fiction as a cultural slavery, because they're always diverting people, or it's escapist, or diverting people away from thinking consciously about what's going on in society. And then I used to call the movements descended from Enlightenment, the naturalism, realism, social realism, socialist realism, as a culture of resistance, because they tend to be looking at what's going on in society, examining it, trying to expose it. And so these are like the basic ideas. And where they relate then to my own art is that I find from studying the history of art, it kind of helps me understand my own work, what I'm trying to do. And this idea of, you know, people below the bottom rung, I had this idea of making it kind of like a geopolitical set of paintings that would cover, you know, the worst situations going on all over the world. And, you know, because nowadays with the internet, we can find out very quickly, and on YouTube see very quickly, we can see videos of what's going on anywhere. And so I started actively looking for what I call bad video. And that is video that's taken with mobile phones. And of course, they have kind of a slower shutter speed, so they could be a little bit blurry. So what fascinated me was the idea of building up a narrative through a triptych, you know, doing three paintings. And so what I would do is I would look for this, like, in the moment type of videos that were done right at the moment things are happening. And then I would make screenshots, lots of screenshots, maybe 50 screenshots. And then I would look for particular scenes which I thought were interesting, because, you know, a scene can change and be aesthetically very different from literally in 1 second to the next. Like, a hand moving down the front of a woman's dress, at one point it's going to have the shadow of the hand on the dress, and a split second later that's going to be gone. So I was looking for these kind of very particular moments in imagery as well. And So I then basically go through them. I would pick out three of them, and they would be like, you know, the beginning of the event, the middle of the event, the end of the event, whatever. Three different aspects of the story of the event, the narrative. And then I would put them together like a little triptych. And then they would become the starting point for the paintings, which would change again once I started drawing them up and painting them. And, you know, sometimes they even changed a little bit with a photographic program on the computer, like maybe, you know, making more contrast or less contrast or changing the tones and the colors, or, you know, just play around with it a little bit. And so then they would become the basis of a triptych. And I work in square canvases, which are like 60 by 60 centimeters. And so I would do the three of them, and then I would put them together as a triptych. And so it's kind of a nice way of working. I tried for a while to do a full narrative in one really big painting, like 150 centimeters. But there I was kind of looking for images that would contain the whole narrative in one image. So for example, there's one painting I did of Kibera slum in Kenya. And I found this really nice photograph that showed the people in the foreground, you know, who inhabit the slum. It showed in the middle ground, the shapes of the buildings that they were living in. And then because they were standing a bit up on a hill, you could see the full extent of the slum going right off into the distance for miles, because it's a massive slum, like one of the biggest in Africa. And so that's kind of difficult to do, to get something that can give you three perspectives in one image. So I decided to revert back to working in smaller paintings and just building up a narrative through three separate images instead. And that's generally the way I'm working at the moment with my paintings.
Just to return to your book again a moment. Thanks very much, because I think you linked your art to your writings quite interestingly there. As I myself, I have a background in science and history of science, so I can't help but wonder, I'm a bit fascinated by it, if you're in any way responding to the idea of, like, let's say, another division that's often made in modern culture between sciences and the humanities. The reason I ask that is because I think, and again, I'm talking a bit in stereotypes here, but which doesn't mean they're necessarily not correct. But well, science is often seen as sort of the more linear, progressive thing that sort of makes advances, moves forward, say in medicine, for example, whereas the humanities are often seen as something where sort of the same ideas may circulate. And art's often put into the humanities, but it seems to me like you're definitely trying to place art in a more in-between space. And I don't know if you were thinking of that divide and of kind of changing it, adjusting it to one, let's say, between the rational and the irrational, which seems to be more your take. Was that at all in your thinking when you...
Well, it's something kind of I've been learning about, you know, because I kind of, you know, root my own ideology and materialism and dialectics. And, you know, recently I was looking at really the scholasticism developed into enlightenment through pantheism. And this is going back to like the 1600s and in England with the diggers. And that really fascinated me, you know, that here you had people who had this idea of God being in nature and being immanent, and not ruling over nature as such. And because they saw God as being in nature, this pantheistic idea that there was no hierarchy in nature, so therefore why should there be hierarchy in society, you know? And so this is kind of like the foundations of their beliefs in democracy and equality. And then over time, that kind of pantheism became more and more materialism, you know, pure science, pure looking at material. And the communitarian aspect of it became more then aligned along with socialist ideology. So over time, it started to change. And of course, that then did affect humanities because, you know, the utopian socialists and the later scientific socialists, I mean, they had a huge effect on the arts, with people working in, you know, the areas of realism and social realism, and then of course also in socialist realism as well. So I've never really seen a separation between science and the arts for that reason. It's always been something I worked along with at the same time. I've never separated them out. I think in Romanticism, the problem is that it's separated out because the Romanticism is based on, you know, the irrational suspicion of reason, of emotions. That's a very different approach. Now, I'm not saying, like I was saying, like, I think actually the real emotions are in Enlightenment and its movements that descended from that, because I think that the real emotion is where somebody is upset at injustice and then they try to work out ways, particularly using science, to solve the injustice. You know, just like, you know, if a good relative of yours was going in, had some serious cancer and they were going into an operating theater, you would want the best science there to get the best emotional outcome, you know. So there's a relationship between emotion and science, I think, in that sense. And in the end, I started to kind of see the Romanticism as being, you know, the kind of emotion of a friend who's only really friendly when they've had a few drinks on them and they're all over you, and then when they're sober, they're not particularly friendly again. Now, these are quite controversial ideas for a lot of people, because, you know, generally the way people analyze or criticize culture is like they like to use the, you know, like a big pot where they throw in a little bit of Enlightenment ideas and throw in some Romanticist ideas and stir it all around, and, you know, this is then forms the basis of their analysis. And what I've been trying to do is completely and utterly separate the two elements, because I personally don't think you can have a science-based movement with little bits of irrationalism thrown in. It's like being a little bit pregnant, you know. It's just, you know, they're not compatible. And once I started developing this idea of separating it out into science and genuine emotion in terms of society and the fight against injustice, the culture of resistance, then I just kept on applying it to more and more different things. So like in the book, I have 10 different art forms that I apply these ideas to. So I went through like music, the history, like generally since Enlightenment times up to today, in dance and music and poetry, in drama, in theater, in opera. Well, television, I looked at it in terms of the Game of Thrones, because it's kind of a conflict there between Enlightenment coming from the South and the kind of a dark medievalist Romanticism from the North, you know, coming into conflict. And I looked at it as well, and particularly in cinema as well, looking at the difference, say, between superheroes and Frank Capra's films of working class heroes. So it's something that I'm just constantly expanding out. I just published an article looking at, looking at the difference between romantic heroes who are kind of alienated and distant and irrational and who are into mysticism, and then comparing them, you know, and anti-conscious, comparing to be like working class heroes who are concerned about the collective, making life better, society better, getting better wages, who are, you know, rational, conscious, and philanthropic, as opposed to, you know, misanthropic. And, you know, comparing the two different ideas, which are very opposite each other, I think. And again, like this, in a way, I think it's kind of enforced that the Romanticism has it's kind of diverted people away from arts that bring about, that are involved in society, involved in life, involved in change. And what I call the Romanticist gloop of horror and terror and fantasy and anything, just diverting you away from what's really going on and what's actually going on in society, which is generally quite dangerous. It's, you know, we've got very belligerent forces around the world, and particularly at the moment it's getting very serious. So it makes me more and more wary now of Romanticist culture, particularly as we get more and more into more, you know, serious scenarios happening. I think science in culture is very important.
So I was thinking certainly I get a strong sense of a sort of many progressive ideals in your art. And by progressive, I mean moving towards a better world and sort of art playing a part in that role. And you're obviously very against the idea of art being a sort of plaything, sort of, or something that happens in a kind of apolitical way while the rest of the world goes on. I think many people are. Conversely, like, has anyone ever discussed with you, or have you ever had the fear potentially that sort of art that moves too far to the political side can become a sort of propaganda, very driven towards a certain political line? And I think this might be a good chance to bring in maybe some of your artistic influences who maybe were inspired by Enlightenment ideals or by political ideals similarly to you. And I mean, I'm certain you don't think you're doing propaganda, but in what sense can art convey a strong political message without becoming, say, didactic or just message-based and so on?
Yeah, and that's a tough one, all right, you know, because in a way, I sometimes wonder, does it depend on class differences? You know, like when a middle-class person looks at a work of socialist realism, they could potentially perceive it very different from a working-class person looking at a work of socialist realism, for example. So, you know, so one person's progressive art is another person's didactic art, you know, so... So I'm very wary, yeah, because, you know, propaganda is a word which just simply means to spread ideas, but it's become politicized in itself, you know. Oh, that's just propaganda. You know, in a way, all art is propaganda because it spreads ideas. I would just more tend to wonder, who's the person making the criticism and what is their standpoint on it. But yeah, I mean, it can become overtly politicized. But then if a painting is overtly politicized, say supporting the Palestinians, you know, does that mean that it lessens the impact of the painting if it's really, 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 really pro the Palestinians? Is it propaganda or is it propaganda for, you know, a better situation for the Palestinians? I know, because people also, I suppose, they think on, you know, art that is kind of defined by the state as being in a certain way, certain direction. But, you know, we could also argue that even in a capitalist state, art is defined by going into a certain direction as well. So, for example, if you look at the Ashcan School of American painters in the 1930s, you know, there was about a group, about 10 of them, and they did these amazing paintings going into slums, and just some really fantastic paintings, like very dynamic, very, not necessarily completely realistic, a little bit, because they had this idea, you know, some of them were using only big brushes and so painting very quickly, very spontaneously to try and get the action and the feel going. You know, they would paint the slums fighting, like boxing matches. They'd paint workers coming out of jobs or poor people on the street or poor people sitting in a window in a slum, you know, building. And so the interesting thing is, though, like that by the end of the 1930s, you know, in a way, the Ashcan School was kind of pushed out as like the Fauvists and, you know, other modernist forms came in and kind of took over. And we didn't see that kind of art again for quite a while. Just same, like, if you take neorealist cinema in Italy, lasted only a certain period of time. Or you take Capra's films, you know, you had, he was doing all these really incredible films about the work class and working class solidarity and, you know, really, really interesting films. And then, of course, you had HUAC, you know, the House of Un-American Activities. And... you know, he was basically forced into standing back from that. And then, you know, his films then by the 50s and early 60s had become quite bland, you know, and it was kind of a pity. But, you know, in other words, like that if you try, you could argue then that, you know, that the ideology of a capitalist state is also propaganda. I mean, the, you know, there's a was a book. She talks about her name is Saunders, Frances Saunders. She talks about how basically in the 1950s, the CIA pumped money into the abstract expressionists so that that became the art of the state, because it was kind of seen as, look, in America here, we're free to do anything we want, not like over there in the Soviet Union where the state forces you to do, socialist realist paintings, which, actually had changed a bit by then anyway. But in that sense, like the art of the state in the United States was becoming abstract expressionism, which even American critics at the time saw it as kind of like the emperor with no clothes. But because all the critics, all the big money, then the big well-known critics who wrote about art had all jumped on board with this, so very just for anybody kind of oppose it. And in terms then, you're saying about my own art then as well. I've just been looking at, because I'm very interested in what's going on around the world, and or reading stories, or looking at images of what happens to people in different places around the world. So, I like this idea that you can produce paintings which are kind of up to the minute in terms of what's going on in the world. Now that's very difficult to do in the arts, because if you want to write a play about a social political event, it could take a year or even years after the event. A film, same thing again. An opera, probably even more time. A book, again, something like that could be brought out fairly quickly. But say, for example, you take music, a ballad. Ballads can appear within days. This happens in Ireland. Something happens in Ireland, and within a few days, there's a ballad out about it. So it's kind of an interesting idea that you could do something similar with art. And one of my other kind of minor projects that I've been working on is looking at the idea of kind of painting around the world, which could be compared with and similar to world cinema. And what I did was I researched lots of different countries looking at what artists they had who had done paintings of ordinary people. So, I would look at, either if they were involved in just simply representations of women, of farmers, of workers, of children, or different activities, like might be involved in riots or street demonstrations or strikes or, all these kind of things. And I set it on up on my blog, like according to each country, and I'd put in as many of these artists as I could, a little bit of a bio on them and stuff. And the interesting thing is then that I was able to look at, once I'd done, I did that for, I don't know, something like 100 different countries. And the interesting thing about that then is that I started then to group them thematically. So I could take a whole bunch of countries and look at how they depicted children in those countries. How do they depict women in those countries? How do they depict workers in those countries? How do they depict farmers in those countries? And so it's very nice. It'd be good if someone was interested in, writing about comparative art. And the thing about this is that if you're working, say, within the realm of, say, abstract art, it's not so easy to do something like that, because it's a bit like airports, It's hard to compare airports because they're all generally more or less the same around the world, in terms of cosmopolitanism, they're generally quite similar. But by looking at depictions of the places, the people, their environment, their societies, you can do a kind of comparative analysis. And another important aspect of what I'm doing is I like the idea of depicting people doing something active and positive, so that the art itself becomes a bit like what Sartre said, to reveal is to change. So you show what's happening in a particular place in the world, and you show local people doing something about it. And then when people, other places then see this, because you reveal that as such, that in itself then creates a kind of an international solidarity, which then can and hopefully inevitably lead to positive change. And so I like the idea. I like that as an idea working within art as well, and on a content level, you know, formal level, realism, mix of realism, and I suppose a little bit of expressionism, a little bit of different things thrown in, all right, you know. But with this idea of a content being primary in terms of looking at and showing what's happening to people, revealing what's happening to people around the world, or drawing people's attention to what's happening around the world.
Yes, and there are any budding artists interested in working on comparative art, please, I suppose they could contact you and we could include.
Oh yeah, it's up on my blog, you know, on my, I have a connection to the blog on my art website, which is gaelart.net, as in Gaelic, G-A-E-L-A-R-T.net. And there's a link there to the blog, and you'll see the blog, you know.
Yes, and we'll link it as well in this podcast, of course. So, yeah, feel free to reach out to Kevin.
Yeah.
So, plenty to talk about here. I think maybe I love this distinction between the formal aspect and the content. I'll just ask one thing about the content that I thought might be interesting. Just in terms of this, obviously, there's so much injustice in the world. There are so many things you could work on. There's almost an infinite array, unfortunately. So I was wondering how you choose your subjects, and in just in terms of the content, how you go about selecting things that you especially want to address from the political point of view. So you mentioned Palestine. I know sort of you've done some work, some artistic work on that. And I know it's not the only thing you've worked on, but is there any kind of, are there any criteria you use to choose your subjects?
Only in really just in terms of what's going on, you know, when I'm generally reading about, you know, the geopolitics, I might notice something which I look at, you know, what's happened to people in a certain place, and I find that interesting. And then that would become the basis of research for a painting then, you know. So I would, you know, said look for video on YouTube as a way of getting imagery for it. So then in terms of form, you know, I like to think of form in a way of how to make that content look interesting visually. And it's a difficult one, you know, because people don't particularly want what I call my horrible and bloody paintings on their wall, you know. So it's a tough one, you know, that you know, people don't really want to be reminded all the time of what's going on around the world. But then again, I find academics don't have a problem buying paintings like that. So it kind of depends. So in a way, you have to kind of try and get a balance between something which is aesthetically interesting and at the same time, you know, not too kind of harsh for people. Because these are harsh things in themselves, so it's quite harsh to have to look at it every day as well. Diego Rivera had a nice approach in a way. Like what he did was he would represent the history or the histories of the Mexican people in a way that showed change in society over long periods of time, and who were the people he would put in all the people who were involved in making those changes. So they're more kind of historical paintings rather than dramatic paintings of, oh, this is happening at the moment. And, you know, he even managed to make quite revolutionary paintings of people with guns and stuff in quite aesthetic ways too, you know. So, because I suppose he's more using more, kind of more realistic methods rather than, you know, expressionist ones, which tend to emphasize more emotion in a way, the emotion of the event. But that's a kind of a project for every artist, you know, how they're going to develop the way they depict events in their art. And like I have a kind of a tongue-in-cheek subtitle for the book, Against Romanticism, a handbook for cultural producers. And the idea of that is that people who work in different art forms can read a little bit about the history of the art form, you know, work in film and poetry and literature, and read a little bit about the history of their art form from this perspective of delineating the kind of what I call the culture of resistance elements and the culture of slavery elements, and separating them out in their minds, and then on that basis, deciding if they want to produce work along those lines themselves, you know. And so I kind of see, I hope that the book would be a kind of a positive thing in that sense of getting even cultural producers to think about the art forms they're working in and ultimately what is the role of their art, what do they want it to do, where do they want it to go, how much they want it to be involved in change in society itself. And I suppose as well to become really aware of how certain forms ultimately just really divert people away from what's happening in their lives. And so in my own work then, it's always an ongoing project. It's always, even if I'm not painting, I'm always thinking, what will be a way of approaching this problem? I mean, that would be interesting visually, you know, and at the same time, without completely losing the content of the work as well. And so it never really ever leaves you, you know. So, you know, the research I'm doing is always very interesting because, you know, because everything you read and write affects what you paint as well. So there's this constant dialectic going on in my head all the time when I'm working.
One question that I thought of before even interviewing you, and I now think I need to unpack it a little bit as a question, was, can art change the course of history? This now feels almost a simplistic question, to be honest, given how we've discussed this. But I was wondering, you do have this, and I guess it goes back to form and content, this quite interesting relation in your work between certainly going back into history for the themes, many of which you mentioned right at the beginning, justice, people being equal before the law, and individual rights. So these are universal themes. We can see them as a kind of abstraction or sort of representing of like an ideal. And that I see that very much as a historian of science relating to that culture of being able to represent sort of notions, physical notions as well. But you're relating it all the time to your art. So looking at material, you said, so like sort of you're working with matter at the artistic level and also working right at the sort of the present day. So as you mentioned, trying to get things out as quickly as possible through ballads and so on. So I'm seeing a line between sort of your historical research effectively in your work and then also like working artistically on the present, like as present day as possible. So based on all that, we can go back to the original question now, but maybe with a bit more context. So can art with this kind of backdrop sort of affect the political discourse, let's say, or change the course of history as it was originally phrased? And if so, how?
You know, the first thing came to mind when you mentioned that, and I think it is a good question, can it change history? And I was thinking, I just suddenly remembered the song Free Nelson Mandela. You know that song? And it became a big hit. I think it was the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. I think it was the 80s. And the fact that song then became a hit around the world, you know, I wonder, did it kind of, you know, reveal the truth of Nelson Mandela to people who wouldn't have known anything about him, and then, you know, result in change? And ultimately, yeah, he was freed then. I think it was in the early 90s, you know. So I think that song, and there is a conscious song, you know, that's not just a love song, you know. A song that became very popular and became almost propaganda sloganeering, you know, free Nelson Mandela, you know, it's pretty direct. As a slogan, you know, you could walk along a demonstration and shout free Nelson Mandela. And here it is on a song that became popular. And ultimately, you know, he was freed a few years later. And I think that song, and this is where I think, you know, when art does become conscious, how it can have a huge effect on a situation. But unfortunately, you know, the next issue then that crops up is, you know, we live in the era of the billionaire media. And, you know, they like romanticism. They like anything that promotes escapism. And you try to bring any forms of art which are, you know, politically progressive, you know, they just get ignored or attacked, or it can be very difficult to get art kind of seen at that level to bring about change. And then, of course, there's what I call form poor art. And that is when the generally, you know, educated middle class artists, you know, in all forms I'm talking about here, are heavily involved in Romanticism. And then the communities that are, you know, suffering whatever social political problems produce their own art, their own arts, their own theater, their own paintings, their own murals, their own slogans, their own songs, but they are amateurs. So that's what I call it, form poor art. But at the same time, it's also very progressive art, but it's form poor, and because it's coming from the community. And so that's why I think you have a nice combination of artists who do think progressively, who have the skills and the training to do really, really good art. And not that there's anything wrong with the form poor art, but I'm just kind of drawing attention to it, because art will out, you know, art will happen whether the artists get involved or not, because people will make their own art instead then, you know, they just do it themselves. And because they see it as an important part to show. I mean, think of the murals in Belfast, or, you know, the muralists in Mexico, or all around the world, whatever struggle is going on. People are making songs or paintings or books about it. You know, I love a lot of African literature, because it's European art tends to be more romantic, psychological. African art is much more social. If you think of artists like Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and there's a whole rake of them, or, you know, Aswani Sembene, you know, these writers who produce all these really fascinating books about, they're like social realist books of what's going on in different countries in Africa. And I find them absolutely fascinating as literature to read, you know, really, really fascinating. So yeah, first of all, you have to have the trained artists, you know, changing their consciousness towards content. Then you have to have a medium which can be put on the stage, and I mean, like a world stage or a local stage, or, you know, it can be very difficult to get the art out of the situation. So that's like the next kind of obstacle. And I suppose there are the two main obstacles, really, you know, like the production of the art, and then getting the art out of the local community to make people aware of what's going on. So it is a struggle, you know, to making that kind of work. So it's not an easy path to take either. It's not going to sell you loads of paintings in a local exhibition. Like, I have also done a series of paintings of Dublin, because I'm fascinated also with the very strong light, like you get in Spain, you know, really, really strong light and strong shadows and strong contrasts. So I went around Dublin taking photographs only as the sun was setting. So you get, or, you know, you get these very long dark shadows and very, very, very bright light. And I did a series of paintings of Dublin based on these images, and they sold very well. But with political work, it doesn't sell so well. I mean, you get a lot of kudos for it, in the sense that I get requests on a regular basis from around the world, from writers who have found an image from my political series, the geopolitical series, and write to me, and I said, oh, can I use this in the cover of your book? And I said, yeah, sure, we'll probably work away, you know. So you get a lot of kind of kudos for it, you know, but it's difficult to sell that kind of art. So yeah, it's not easy working like that. But if you enjoy, I mean, I enjoy working in that area, in this area, and also looking at the history of this as well, looking at this kind of radical history of art. And I think in a way, with the crash, a lot of artists may have, for example, changed their work for the market. And in a way, what I tried to do is change the market for my work. You know, in other words, if you can kind of get people to take an interest in socially or socio-politically conscious work, then they will understand what you're doing. So that it's just a kind of a different approach to it, which is a much more long-term thing as well. So I think in any country, certain types of work will kind of go along unnoticed for a long period of time until something happens in the country, and then suddenly people start looking at it. You know, when people's consciousness has changed a little bit, then they look at art a bit differently as well. They start to look for more from art too. So you're kind of working along generally with those kind of parameters.
Thanks very much. That's a very interesting answer. As a final question, I thought I'd almost ask something very related, but kind of like the converse question. So I asked you how art effectively can be radical, revolutionary, how it can change the course of history. Let's take radical revolutionary art as something that you produce and also that other artists produce. As you say, art will out. Are you open to the idea that other artists inspired by very different ideals to you could also produce such revolutionary art? So the reason I ask that is because, I mean, I'm not an art critic, so I don't know very much about how explicit artists are about their themes, but you seem to be at least more explicit than usual in that you've written a book and you've explained some of the ideas that drive your work, which is obviously the work on the Enlightenment and Romanticism. So in a sense, this makes it easier to ask you this question because you've been very open about your inspirations and your ideals. And I don't know if all artists are, I suppose, although presumably there are ideas that maybe aren't written down sometimes. But I hope it's a slightly challenging question, but I wonder what you think. So are you open to the idea that maybe an artist could produce revolutionary work and maybe not agree with you in terms of like the Enlightenment having this relationship to like the radical tradition?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm not here to, I like the idea of just promoting or provoking discussion around the whole area. The thing is that there's, you know, generally, there is very little discussion, I find. I mean, even this, the idea of producing this as a book is to open up a debate with other artists and cultural producers about what is art, what is progressive art, what is not, what is just simply escapism, what ties in with society, what doesn't. And it may even just simply just other artists who just maybe have not thought about art so much in that way. I don't know. But for me, because it is quite a polemical piece of work, you know, for me, the polemics are to get people thinking about art in a certain way. I mean, I met a Moldovan guy, a friend of a friend of mine, and he's quite a well-known theater director and actor, and I think he writes drama as well. And we were in a good long discussion about these ideas. And, you know, after a while, I said, so now this style of theatre, now would that be Enlightenment, do you think, or Romantic? And I said, well, that's definitely Enlightenment. And this style of theatre, oh, that's definitely more of a Romanticist area. He said, oh, it's very interesting. And you can see how his whole way of thinking about the arts, his own area of art, was starting to change. And that was great, you know, having that discussion with him, because then once we'd kind of talked about it in this way, then we could start talking about, well, what would be interesting ideas in terms of arts going forward, or he could think about in terms of the way he wanted to go forward with it as well. So I think, yeah, for me, you know, because it's quite a polemical approach, the idea is to kind of provoke discussion and let those artists take it wherever they want to take it. It's all totally up to them. They may not use it at all, you know, but at least to be more aware of the kind of the history of their own art. And I think that's good, at least being conscious of your own art in this kind of way. It is at least a good start.
Okay, Keith Yeen, I think we've come to the end of all my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add regarding your own work, perhaps, or any other ideas you felt you hadn't covered?
Not really. We've certainly covered a lot. I mean, I have, if anyone is interested in what I've been talking about, the book is up on Amazon as a Kindle version. We're having a bit of a problem getting the print-on-demand version because there's a lot of illustrations in the book. But I have printed copies at home here. My email address is on my website as well, if anybody wants to email me about any aspect of it. And I would love to see some kind of a filmed documentary made, you know, based on this idea. I think that would be really, really interesting, looking at Enlightenment or Romanticist ideas in a film, like a film version of the book. I think it would be amazing if someone does documentaries. I think they might find that an interesting project to do. But I can be contacted through the website. And always interested in somebody who wants to engage in dialogue about the ideas. It's great. My articles are published on Globe Research, Dissident Voice, culturematters.co.uk, various different websites. So if they Google my name, they'll find them. They've all been published online, so they don't really have to buy the book if they want to. I mean, the book is expanded from the articles, but I planned out the book as a series of about 15 articles and then put them together and expanded them into the book so they can just go to the website if they have an interest in any of this at all.
Yes, any budding filmmakers, or indeed not budding, but fully established filmmakers, if you're interested in Kim Yin's work, give him a ring or a buzz or an internet signal.
Really fascinating.
So thanks very much, Kim Yin, for joining Culto Rico and having a chat about your work. And I hope the listeners enjoyed it too.
Thanks very much. It's great to talk to you again.
And I hope the listeners can join us for the next podcast on Culto Rico. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Culto Rico was produced by Alexander Brown. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at culturico.com. To get our latest episodes, subscribe to Culturico on your podcast platform of choice. If you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.